for the invitation. And first of all, I apologize for those who might prefer fancy pictures. That will be a talk. All that I'm going to speak about is joint work with Patrick Gérard and Nikolai Dyatkov. Both from Orsay. So the problem I'm interested in is nonlinear Schrödinger equation, which is I dt plus Laplace u equal f of u at time t equals 0 is some initial data, u naught is some subordinate space. So M will be a manifold and compact. Most of the time. Okay, so F is the nonlinearity. I will assume that F is smooth and satisfies a Gauss invariance, which is that basically F is C V bar of some potential of V of modulus of Z. Okay, so typically F is what you think means that if it were not smooth, would be modulus of U. P minus 1 U.
So you do not include the T minus 1 R.
Well, it won't even be an additional number, an integer. I assume that what I put that I will take, for example, F, the more reasonable F would be something like that. F of U equal 1 plus modulus of U square to P minus 1 over 2 U, because that is smooth. I don't want to get into problems with the non-smoothness of the non-linearity, but probably some part of what I'm speaking about would work for some non-so-smooth non-linearities, but I don't want to get into this kind of stuff. Okay, so when you have that, you have, of course, two conservations, which is the L2 norm of U and the energy of U, which is norm of gradient of U square plus V of U. And in all that, so I take M, the manifold, with a Riemannian metric. And I consider the Laplace operator associated to that metric. And when I integrate on the manifold, I integrate with respect to the natural measure. Okay, so this is E of t equal, constant. Okay, so when the nonlinearity in the energy V is, say, positive or at least not too negative, then the energy controls the gradient of U. If V not too negative, and consequently the study of that, the existence, local existence of nonlinear Schrödinger equation, has a particular interest in L2 and H1. Because once you have a local existence result, you have a global existence result simply by using the conservation laws, and so you have solutions which are defined for any time. And then you may wish to study the dynamic as t tends to infinity, but that's another story. Okay, for compact manifolds, as far as I know, I think there are absolutely no results of local well-posedness in L2. And I will explain a little why it's almost, well, difficult to think that you can prove a result in L2. However, in H1, there are some results. And before stating what we've done, I'm going to give you a little survey of the known results for H1 existence on manifolds. So, of course, it depends on the dimension. D equal 2. The first result is Rézy-Galouette. And uses the fact that in dimension 2, H1 of M is almost included in L infinite of M. Simply by Sobolev embedding, so you miss the L infinite norm by a log, and using that, you have global existence in S, strictly greater than 1, for strong solutions, and even for F equal 1, you have global existence and uniqueness for H1 solution. HS, so this S is that one. For P smaller than 3.
Would you be assuming throughout this kind of energy-bound position, there'd be not two negative assumptions throughout?
Oh, for that? Oh, this is, let's say, for that, let's even put it. I'm assuming for all these global existence results, I'm assuming that B is positive. Let's say, or not too negative. It controls the N1 norm. Otherwise, different. I'm sorry?
What's the difference between the S equals 1 phase and the S greater than 1 phase?
Wow, okay. For S greater than 1, the solutions are strong. For S equal 1, there are always weak solutions, simply by regularizing and you have global solution and then passing to the limit by compactness. For S equal 1, the result is that the solutions are weak, are unique. But they are not strong. Okay, but anyway, it's somehow obsolete since we can do better. So the second result is the Dutoux-Bourguin. Oh, sorry. Yeah, that is okay. So Bourguin showed that if M is T2. Mm-hmm. Oh, shit. It is 5, I think. Approximately. Bourguin must be in the 90s. 95, maybe. Maybe, probably less than 95, probably less, more than 90. So for T2, you have local existence for S positive. And hence, of course, global existence for S equal 1. And strong solutions. And for any P, for Bourguin's result, P. Okay, now I have a result in which is any M, any P for F equal 1, it's okay. And if P is finite, you can compute precisely the S, which is relevant. Okay, so essentially, in dimension 2, on a compact manifold, you have a very good existence, well-posedness fitting. Now, in dimension 3, well, here you have, for any P, S depends of P for local existence, and the S of P is always strictly smaller than 1. Or maybe, no, sorry. No, in dimension 2, okay, yeah. S of P, which is smaller than 1, for the local existence, and hence you have global existence in H1 for any nonlinearity. In dimension 2, no, that is precisely maybe something that I can say now that I wanted to say later, is that S of P is greater than 1/4, and the scaling, for example, P equals 3, the scaling is 0, and we can prove that the problem is somehow in some weak sense, ill-posed in for S smaller than 1/4. Some weak ill-posedness for in HS for P, which is greater than 1, smaller than 3, and S smaller than 1/4. So something curious happens in that there is a threshold, which is 1/4, which does not depend on the nonlinearity, meaning that you can take any very, very, very weak nonlinearity, your problem is ill-posed, which is not the case, which is in contrast with the result of Bourguin on the two-dimensional torus or the classical results in R2, for which the problem is well posed in L2, in R2. Okay. I'm sorry? What? No, you don't, unfortunately, you don't lose continuity. That's what, it's a weak ill posedness. You lose uniform continuity only. Well, losing continuity would be a strong ill-posedness result. So it's only a loss of uniform continuity. Okay. Now. In dimension 3, oh, that's better. That's much better. So the first result in dimension 3 is Bourguin's result, about 5, which is M T3. And Bourguin's result tells you that the problem is well posed for P strictly smaller than 5 and S equal 1. So the problem is well posed in H1 for subquintic nonlinearities. And here the scaling limit for P equal 5 is precisely 1. So Bourguin's result is in perfect accordance with the scaling machinery. I sent results as in R3, except that now in R3 you can add here the equality case. Okay, now the other result in this direction is our result, which tells you M, any M, And then you have exactly the analog of Brzezinski-Galois result. It tells you that for S greater than 1, it's globally well posed. And for S equal 1, also except that you have only weak solutions. Weak solutions are unique. And P, here P is smaller than 3. So the result is, on this sense, less good as that one. So what I want to explain today is how you can extend Bogen's results to the case. So, well, I can state a theorem. Theorem. So the theorem is that if P let M equal S3 or S1 times S2, then NLS is well posed in H1 for P smaller than 5. So it means that we have exactly the same results as in the torus or as in RD, R3, except that you miss the critical case for the spheres. So somehow, maybe I can make a comment about that. This is in contrast with what happened here. So here in dimension 2, for cubic nonlinearities, there is a real difference between the case of spheres or the case of weak ill-posedness. This is for S2. So here, for cubic nonlinearities, the geometry of the manifold plays a real role. Here, this result, of course, it's particular cases, spheres, but these results say somehow that the geometry is expected not to play a role for the local well-posedness theory. Okay, so maybe. Well, once it's in H1, it's global. But the local theory does not see the sign of the nonlinearity. So it's local for any nonlinearity, and then global if the nonlinearity is defocusing. Well, this, whether it's optimal or not.
So defocusing nonlinearity, the answer is the local. The answer is dependent on time. Yeah. So sometimes, yeah.
Depends. Okay. Aviv?
Topological theories and geometrical theories.
Oh, these are the standard spheres with the standard metric, geometrical. Ah, yeah. It's not a question of topology, and I will explain why we are only able to study these kind of manifolds. These are very particular. Now, that is not a question of topology. It's really a question of geometry. Okay, so maybe before going further, I will make a few comments. So first comment is that for higher dimensions, what happens? So for higher dimensions, there is one result, which is D equals 4, M is T4, Bogen's result, which it says that it's okay for P smaller than 2. S greater than 1, and it's global then if it's defocusing. same kind of result as with this Galouette, this result, or our result, S greater than 1. And probably you could do S equal 1 with weak solutions, but he didn't write it. And then, for bigger, for F, D equals 6, for example, we have exactly the same kind of result as here. We have a weak Hilbertness in H1. So it means that you can construct many, many weak solutions, and these weak solutions are, in some sense, unstable, a weak form of instability. On spheres. And probably we are working now to microlocalize that, and probably we hope to be able to do that if you have an elliptic trap trajectory, a trap trajectory which is stable. That is related to things like that. So second comment is that, oh, P is, I think P is 2 is okay, but I would not bet on it. We have, in the paper we have the precise P which works, but and it has to be bigger than 1, of course. These are for small p's. Okay, second comment is that this result of local well-personness is optimal in a strong sense. So it's optimal because there is a theorem of Christ Colliander Tau, which states that if you take S positive and strictly smaller than the critical index, then nonlinear Schrödinger equation is ill-posed in a strong meaning that the flow is not continuous. Not continuous. I mean that flow, if it exists, it is not continuous at t equals 0, u naught equals 0. And in fact, they wrote that result for m equal rd, but it's not difficult to see that adapting their proof, it works in fact for any manifold. In fact, the proof can be completely local. And of course, since here for p equal 5, f critical of p equal 5 is 1, it means that if you take p very close to 5 and s strictly smaller than 1, then the problem is not well posed. Simply by using this result. Well, non-continuity means that you can build sequences which go to 0 at time t equals 0 and which in very small time go to infinity, which is a strong Hilbertness result. Okay. Now I'm going to try to explain you a little bit what is behind that result, and relate that, so that will be a second part, which are bilinear Strieker's estimates. Okay, so first I'm going to recall the linear Strieker's estimates in RD. then if you consider e to the it Laplace u naught, the solution of the linear Schrodinger equation, equal u, and then you have norm of u lp in time with values rz in x is smaller than c, norm of u naught L2, and of course you have conditions on P and D, which are D over 2, let's say 2 over P plus D over Q equals D over 2, and basically you can think of this simply by taking P equal infinity D 2, and this is the conservation of the L2 norm, which is not very new result. And what is more interesting is the other one, the other extremal one, P equal 2. Oh, no, that's not D. It's Q equal 2. And then Q equal 2D over D minus 2. And D equal 2 is forbidden. Well, for P equal 2. This extremal one is false for D equal 2. And all the other are basically interpolation between these two ones. Okay. I'm sorry? Oh, LQ. Q over D. Thank you. That's better this way. Okay, so maybe you can see that saying that if you look at that one, this result tells you that you can estimate the LQ norm by the L2 norm. And if you think of the Sobolev injection tells you exactly that H1 is included in this space. So Sobolev is exactly that. So this estimates H1 included in H 2D over D minus 2. So this three-cost estimate is again of one derivative. You have changed an H1 injection into an L2. Well, using the fact that you have solution of a PDE, of course. And losing also the LP norm in time. Is it? L, oh, sorry. That's L. That's better. Okay, D equal 2, you have exactly H1 in L infinite and almost. Okay. Now what happens for a compact manifold is that you know that this is false. This cannot hold true. Simply by looking at eigenfunctions. You look at eigenfunctions on the sphere. On SD. And you can compute the LP norm. Of course, for eigenfunction, minus Laplace En equal lambda n En. E to the IT Laplace En is e to the it lambda n en. So of course, time plays no role. So it can't be global, first. That is trivial. But even if you take a bounded subset of our t, you know that this cannot hold true because simply the norm of En in LQ is not bounded. It blows up with lambda, smaller than lambda n to some power s of Q. So since it blows up, even taking here the interval 0, 1 instead of the global T, but cannot be true, simply because the left-hand side goes to infinity while the right-hand side stays bounded. So this is the phenomenon of loss of derivatives, which explains that you will have problems solving in L2. Because once you've lost these derivatives, you have problem to regain them. Yes?
Why is that?
What I say is that. To compute the norm of e to the it Laplace en Lp in time, Q in x. LQ norm blows up even if the L2 norm stays bounded.
Yeah, that's an upper bound.
Okay, this is lambda to the F of Q. Oh, sorry. That's better. In fact, okay, maybe I can. You should simply want to see this. Well, on the general manifold, we know very few about eigenfunctions, but it is not expected at all that you have eigenfunctions bounded. Even if, well, on the torus, well, speak about the torus. Most eigenfunctions are unbounded on the torus, except in dimension 2, simply because of multiplicity. You have many eigenfunctions which are bounded. But if you take a linear combination of these eigenfunctions on Torah, usually they are unbounded because due to multiplicity. So I think that except in dimension 2, for the 2D torus, we know no manifold for which the eigenfunctions are bounded with respect to the L2 norm. Irrational torus. I think you know nothing about irrational torus. Whether they're bounded or not. You're right. But then, what I'm going to explain will show you that eigenfunctions are not the good object. You have to study spectral projectors. Okay, so it means that if you want to prove Twiekart's estimate of that kind, you are going to lose here, and you are going to lose powers of lambda. So, of course, can state the result now. So, theorem 2. I take M a manifold, and then I consider EM the eigenfunctions, smooth, compact, smooth, any dimension, and then norm of EM is smaller than C, the minimum of L and M to the 1/4, T equal 2, and C, the minimum to the D minus 2 over 2, log of the minimum to the 1/2 for D equal 3, and C, the minimum to the D minus 2 over 2 for D greater than 4. Okay, so this is the kind of results.
What's the norm on the left side?
What's the L2 norm? So it amounts to computing an L4 norm for the eigenvalues. So it's basically here. I'm going to concentrate on the case Q. Corresponds to the case Q equal 4. So this time it is an upper bound that could correspond to compute S of Q is what I put on the right-hand side to the 1/2. Except that for reasons that will appear after, I want to pay on the right-hand side only the minimum. I do not want to pay the maximum at all. Okay, so, write it there. Corollary. M equals S3, then you have, if U naught is sum of lambda n, U naught n, let's call it un, of un en. So I take initial data which are in frequency of order n, and um defined in a similar way. Then you have the bilinear three-cost estimate which tells you that norm of e to the it Laplace um e to the it Laplace um L2 01 or maybe 02 times S3 is smaller than the minimum of n and m to the d minus 2 over 2, which was d equals 3, but d minus 2 over 2 plus epsilon, c times c epsilon, right? For any epsilon positive exists c epsilon. For any. And I have to put norm of un L2, norm of um L2. Okay, so the corollary tells you that if you accept to pay d minus 2 over 2, which is 1/2, because d equals 3, if you accept to pay 1/2 of a derivative, then you have a nice bilinear three-cost estimate. Tells you here, somehow you have here to put an H 1/2 norm. Okay. Now maybe a comment why the first theorem, as you can see, is holds true for any manifold, whereas the second one relies heavily on the fact that the manifold is a sphere, a geometrical sphere. And you can understand this this way. Well, first, I have, before that, say that what is important in our theorem there is precisely the fact that it is bilinear. If you want to do something with estimates like that for nonlinear Schrodinger, it has to be bilinear. Linear estimate will help you not at all. So, but the linear estimate was known, and its Sauger's result, I think it's 86, the case M equals M. And in Sauger's results, in fact, there are plenty of other LP norms which are computed. Well, for the bilinear estimate, basically we can compute the L2, and we also have trilinear estimates, which are of some use in the S times S2 result.
Yeah?
Yeah?
Which is, this is spectral projectors, because of course you're taking a three-dimensional analyst in energy space.
Mm-hmm.
S3. but of course some eigenfunctions see others more.
Well, in fact, how will... Okay.
Just have to do with where they are in the energy range, right? If you could take a annulus of that, which sits around the equator, then you can make the problem look more two-dimensional. I mean, it's a...
I'm sorry, I didn't get it.
Yours is a homogeneous estimate, but it need not. But if you consider inhomogeneous estimates, it may be homogeneous in energy, but it may be even better if it's not necessarily so. It's clear to see if you look at all.
Okay. In fact, what we would like, would be not to rely at all on a stationary estimate like that, but do the whole work on the time evolution problem. That would be even much nicer. And maybe I can explain a few things about that. In fact, if you think of Bogan's result for the tourist, T3, our result S time S2, S3. The eigenfunctions in these three cases are very different. For that one, the eigenfunctions are very good. Yeah. Bad spectrum. For that case, the eigenfunctions are bad, and the spectrum is good, because the spectrum of the Laplace operator on spheres is basically it's n, the n plus d minus 1, so basically it's n squared. And the eigenvalues are very, very well separated, so they don't interfere on the sphere. Exactly. And that case is an intermediate one. The eigenfunctions are not so good, not so bad, and the spectrum is not so good, not so bad. And what is funny is that on these three examples, by different methods, you arrive to exactly the same critical point. F equal 1, P equal 5. Okay, now I'm going to explain rapidly, and I won't have time to explain that, but at least I can explain you how we can obtain from that, because that is easy. What you do is that you compute everything. So u e to the, let's call it, this is u, that one, well, let's compute. We're going to compute simply the L2 norm. Oh, maybe. I took here this simply because due to the form of the spectrum, it is periodic. So 0, 2 pi is very well suited to computations. And now you compute the L2 norm and you have something like that. Sum of n of e to the it, let's say, n square. I'm not going to work with this n plus d minus 1, but simply change it to n square. It doesn't change anything. un. Sum of e to the it m square vm. I'm computing the L2 norm in t and x. I simply say the L2 norm, I can simply take the conjugate here, so it will be minus. That's a little simpler. Changes nothing. And now it's simply the sum on n and m of e to the it n square minus m square un of x, em of x, and 2 in time on x. I simply perform transfer in the t integration. So if n square minus m square are distinct, then these terms are orthogonal. So it's simply the term on tau of the norm L2 of the term on n square minus m square equal tau of un cm en of x cm of x. And now it's L2 in x. I take squares here everywhere. No. And now what happens is that you simply do Cauchy Schwarz. So it's smaller than the sum of two and the supremum of sum of n squared minus m squared equal to n over the capital N, m over the capital M of 1 squared sum on n squared minus m squared, well, sum on n on m of un squared um square norm of en em q square. Okay, and now it's finished because all these will turn, so simply it will be smaller than the supremum on two of the cardinal of this set times what? Times two norm of u zero un um L2 square times precisely the minimum to the 1/2. We didn't lose epsilon yet. And now we are losing epsilon here. You compute the supremum on two of the cardinal of the set of n and m such that n squared minus m squared equal to n over the capital N and m over the capital N. And this is smaller than the minimum of n and m to the epsilon. Okay, what is completely standard is that it's smaller than the maximum. That's really standard number theory, number of presentation of a number of the sum of two square or difference. In fact, you can say simply it's the number is related to the number of divisors of two, of prime divisors of two. And seeing that we can take the minimum is not difficult at all, since n is much smaller than m, then there is only one possible couple, simply because if you take two different m's, then the difference here will be too large to be compensated by the n's. So if n is much smaller than m, it's one. And if n is not much smaller than m, smaller than m to the epsilon, which is n to the epsilon. Okay, now I have no time to explain you how from this you can go to proving nonlinear Schrodinger, but in fact, well, there is some kind of numerology, but it's not very difficult. Then once you have that, you can put the machinery of Bourguin of Vixer Spira spaces and, well, it's kind of tricky computations, but it works. Thank you.